Hashtag psychotherapy unfucked with Mark Fielding.
Hello, welcome to series 5, episode 3 of Hashtag psychotherapy unfucked. As you know, I'm Mark Fielding, psychotherapist and relationship counsellor and your host. Today, I have the absolute pleasure of introducing Matthew Starrett. We will be talking about all things attachment and much, much more, and sticking to our Series 5 theme around relationships. Matthew is an integrative counsellor psychotherapist based in Surrey and London, working with individuals. He is experienced in working with relational conflict, trauma, grief, and addiction. He brings his experience of mindfulness and meditation to his practice. He is BACP registered. Prior to working as a therapist, Matthew worked as a professional musician for 15 years. During this time, he toured the UK and Europe extensively, had his music featured in TV and film, and performed at some of the world's biggest music events, including Glastonbury and South by Southwest. He continues to manage and front a successful events band, The Thamesmen. Matthew also hosts the podcast, The Journey Home, which I've recently subscribed to, and I have to say it's absolutely excellent. So we'll obviously, you know, we'll include the link to the podcast along with all Matthew's other links with the podcast and on our social media sites. So thank you so much for coming on, Matthew. It's nice to meet you.
And you, thank you so much for having me, Mark. It's a pleasure.
I mean, I always kick off asking our guests about the personal experiences that brought them into the field. And obviously, Matthew, say as much or as little as you're happy to.
Yeah. So I guess my interest in working as a therapist was lit a number of years ago. I've had a lot of personal therapy myself. And whilst I was working as a musician, I sustained a bit of an injury, which I've never really got to the bottom of, but I know something happened. And I just remember being met the following morning with a lot of pain. And I did my best managing it, but I'd sort of got to a point where I was struggling with the day-to-day stuff around playing music. And I was doing some pretty deep work myself. And I don't really know the exact moment. I just think it was I wonder what that would be like. And historically, being someone who may overthink, to put it lightly, I think I just thought, I'll go with that. I don't know what that means, but I'm just going to go with that. I think working in the music industry for a number of years, there've been some fantastic stuff, but it, alongside some of the physical issues I was having, I think I'd just gotten to a bit of a place of maybe existential crisis. I'm not sure if that's too big a phrase, but I think a bit of that stuff was going on. So I just thought, maybe there's something here. I don't know what, but I'm just going to put one foot in front of the other. So yeah, that was kind of my journey.
Yeah. So I guess from what you're saying, so the injury was a bit of a catalyst, really, for you moving into the therapy area. I'm going to, you know, use a counselling cliche, but a bit of a crossroads where.
absolutely.
Yeah,
for sure. Yeah.
Could I ask, I'm really interested to hear a bit more about your musical career and, you know, performing at Glastonbury. I mean, back in the day, you know, I used to go to Glastonbury, so I know the place very well. And also some of the TV and film. Could you say a little bit more about that?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it's nice to be asked and nice to think about some of that stuff. I haven't thought about that for a while. So I'd always been really into music. I think when a lot of other stuff didn't make sense growing up, music just made sense. And I just followed that. It was the one constant, really, I would say, looking back. I moved around a lot as a kid. I always felt a bit unsure of where my home was, where my friends were.
Yeah.
Map of the world stuff was a bit scattered. School was really tough for me, but it was just the one constant. It was like something I didn't have to think about, going back to that sort of overthinking thing. It just made sense. So I guess I started playing in bands very young, and then just through sort of teenage into early adulthood, playing with various bands of various different genres. And I started playing with a band called Treetop Flyers when I was about 22. So that was quite a pivotal moment. And we just all kind of had the idea of just going for it. We managed to kind of build up a bit of a following. And yeah, that just kind of led, one thing led to another, really. So Glastonbury, first time we did that, it was great. But I think we played like five shows there in 24 hours. So it's pretty brutal. It was a kind of, you're going to do it. So we just crammed in, which was cool. But I do remember, before I joined Treetop Flyers, I had kind of been in a different phase of my life. It was a bit of a dark time. So when I'd sort of come out of that and entered into recovery, it was all very different, the music industry. So I was going on the road and doing all these things, and it was like, I want to be doing this, but there's all this other stuff that's quite difficult. And from what I remember about Glastonbury, it was amazing, but also quite intense. Like a lot of people doing all sorts of things at all sorts of times and all sorts of places. And but no, I feel proud about it. Yeah, I think that was great. I think the TV stuff, we went out to the States to make a record, which was really fun. We lived in just outside Los Angeles for a while, which was cool. Made a record, and just through, we'd signed a record deal at that point in the UK and then later in the USA. And I think just through that kind of just various stuff in that world, we got a song on a film, the sequel to Dumb and Dumber, which I think is just called Dumb and Dumber 2. But yeah, it was really cool. Like, a kind of mixed feelings in many ways. Like, I feel really proud, but also, yeah, it was a bizarre world, I found it in some ways. I don't know if that answers your question and kind of where you were wanting to go, but that's, I guess, what comes up for me.
No, absolutely. I mean, really, really interesting. So I guess some a bit of a kind of shadow side to it, possibly, as well.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it always, I guess, I've seen that can come up in many areas of life, but a sense of this thing that was my passion, but everything else that went with it. Whereas once there were bits that were okay about that, there was almost like a split between as soon as I get on stage or as soon as I create, that's fine. But then sitting with the other stuff was quite tricky. And I think that can really extend to so many careers and walks of life, this idea that loving what we do, but that kind of notion that suffering is a part of life and there's going to be things in each area that can be quite difficult, and trying to navigate that, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we'll segue in if it's okay to
Of course.
a main kind of topic. And this isn't a I have to say for our listeners who are not familiar with attachment theory, this is an enormous field, but we'll just try and cover the basics here. I mean, and I'm going to start off with a really, really enormous question, Matthew. What is attachment theory?
Oh gosh, yeah. I mean, I think I would totally agree with you. It is a pretty enormous
It
one.
is.
So I guess the most concise way, I guess, of explaining it for me, that still I sometimes need when I find myself still kind of coming back to it and thinking, have I got all of this? I guess so. It's an advanced relationship science drawing on evolution, psychology, and ethology. That was formulated by John Bowlby. And he suggested that our attachment behavior is linked to evolutionary survival strategies for protecting an infant from predators. I quite like that version. And obviously, it's something that's inherent in all of us. And depending on what we experience, it will depend how we are in relationship. So, for anyone who doesn't know, there are. I mean, again, this is a pretty big field and people talk about all different sorts of stuff, but there were four main attachment styles. So there's secure, anxious, ambivalent, avoidant, dismissive, and disorganized. But yeah, I think that's important to mention. But I guess that's probably the most hopefully concise way of describing it.
And I guess it's come a little bit more. I mean, I don't know whether you'd agree with this, into the kind of public domain over the last few years. There's a book called Attached. I don't know whether you've come across that book.
Yeah, I have. Yeah, I
Yeah.
can see it on my bookshelf above, actually. Yeah, really good book. Yeah, I
Yeah,
like that book.
really accessible. I mean, I just love that book because it's really accessible as well. So, for a general audience, I think it's
Yeah.
a really, really excellent book. I mean, in terms of adult relationships, and again, big question, how do the different attachment types kind of play out in relationship? Just maybe we could look at the three or four, and just maybe you could give an idea of how they tend to play out. And
Yeah,
again, there's a lot of
absolutely.
complexity because obviously it depends who
Yeah.
the other partner is, but as much as you can.
Oh yeah, absolutely. No, it's really fascinating, and I think it's a really good reference you made there, because I know, just as a sort of a caveat to that, I remember when I first came across it, it was actually through that book a number of years ago, and I found it really, really accessible because, there's a lot of dense stuff on many topics,
There
but
is.
actually, as an adult reading something, I really liked that. So I thought, yeah, really good, helpful nod there for sure. And I think that's a really useful text. But going back to your question, so yeah, I guess just imagining everyone in relationships. So we're all relational beings, going back to that evolution aspect, and we influence each other. We all bring our stuff. So I guess if I'm looking at one of the main attachment styles. So, for example, someone with an anxious attachment style, they might react to conflict by using protest behavior to get their partner's attention. And obviously, none of this is exact, set in stone. I mean, I think even, attachment theory is a science, but I always kind of think there's no sort of MRI machine to sort of scan. And I think
No.
so, which I quite like all that. I think it's humans are so subjective, it really helps this stuff, but it can vary. So
Agree.
drifting off a bit there, but if perhaps someone has a more avoidant attachment, and that might be more stereotypically, they might be more introverted. I mean, that's a kind of old, before attachment theory, I think that's a kind of Carl Jung thing, the introvert, the extrovert, which I guess links a bit here. But yeah, if the person has an avoidant attachment, it might be that they close down more emotionally, and when I say close down, that's kind of internally, perhaps. So physically they might be there, but it could be that their body language changes. They just sort of take on a kind of more solemn stance, and a sort of air of defensiveness and independence. So I guess something that I remember, you mentioned the book Attached, and there's a book called Hold Me Tight, which is by Dr. Sue Johnson, emotionally focused
Love
therapy.
that
And
book.
yeah, there was something in there which, again, there's sort of these little nuggets that's, throughout reading these books, they can be quite heavy sometimes and difficult to read, but just the odd, for me anyway, some of these kind of bits that stood out. And I remember it was something in that book, and I'm probably paraphrasing, so I don't, please don't quote me on this, but I really liked how she said that both people are probably asking for the same thing or a similar version of that. Because I think that can be a difficulty sometimes. I guess whenever there's a label, it's like there can be a risk of better than, worse than, different,
Definitely.
which, yeah. And I think that can come into this here. Someone perhaps reading a book like Attached, or doing a, there's certainly been adaptations, but the original adult attachment interview, the sort of paradox of doing that and finding out that they might be anxiously attached, it could lead to perhaps some shame, like, oh, am I not, should I be this or should I be that? So I think always kind of recognizing, I think even, with a secure attachment, difficult days, we can, as humans, pivot between different attachments.
For
But
sure.
that notion that we're both probably asking for the same thing, but because perhaps we experience different ways of getting our needs met, however love was expressed to us through our primary caregiver, it comes out in different ways. So almost when I was given that example there, that the image that comes to mind is somebody going in, and perhaps the other person, who's maybe the avoidantly attached person, kind of going back, and this sort of tug of war, when perhaps they're both saying, can I trust you? Are you going to be there for me? Will you love me? But they, so if that makes sense, I guess
It
that's always stood
does.
out to me.
Yeah, I mean it's and I guess the dynamic that you're describing, I think, is so common with couples. You know, well, pursue withdrawal, and there's different kind of names for it, aren't there? But you know, but you know, one, both really, you know, kind of both really wanting attachment, but you know, because of childhood experiences, both having developed a different way of, you know, of kind of getting that attachment. And just as you say, you know, the anxious, the person that's anxiously attached will often really, really press for connection, perhaps sometimes press a little bit too hard. There's a, you know, strong feeling behind it. And if they're with an avoidant partner, the avoidant partner will be taking a step back as they're taking a step forward. And I think couples get involved in this really, really, you know, destructive dynamic of pursue withdrawal. But just as you say, both actually want the same thing. It's just different strategies. And also, just to link up what you were saying about shame, and that is also something I see. I mean, in terms of lots of people reading that attached book, it's so easy, I think, to work out your attachment type and then pathologize yourself. You know, and I think it's important to say, you know, everyone has different attachment types. These things are flexible. You know, I mean, so there is, you know, there is no right or wrong. Just as, even a secure person can move, just as you say.
Definitely. And something, I guess I'd kind of thought about it, but not so simply. I was speaking to someone the other day, about attachment, actually, and we're just talking about it. And they said how actually, to kind of validate, they're pretty genius strategies in a way, because those very things may literally have kept children alive.
Definitely,
Perhaps they had to be avoidant or they had to be anxious. So I think, you know, that is something, you know, and that really, I was just thinking, yeah, I think that's so important here. You know, and I guess that, without kind of wanting to stray, the kind of notion of like the nervous system, yeah, it sucks being in fight, flight, freeze. It's really tough, but it's actually a pretty amazing strategy, kind of looking at it like, wow, how we've evolved as humans. It's just these kind of notions of where we get stuck. And I think attachment, for me, it's just, I think it's such a fascinating area, because at some point, probably most days, we'll either have a memory of the past or meet someone. Something's going to happen. Even if we're alone all day, it might be that there's a memory of something that flashes up. And
Definitely.
I kind of think it's just always there, which is just, it's like, yeah, it's so important, I think, this stuff.
And you know, the I think the idea, you know, to keep in mind that these are strategies that, you know, primarily were put in place in order to keep a lot to stay alive, I think is so important to remember. Because the I guess when people are feeling, I guess, you know, they're wanting to avoid, they're wanting to, you know, pursue, these triggers are enormous. I mean, they literally are life and death triggers. And I think the feelings that are evoked, you know, by these triggers, you know, feel like that. I mean, with that in mind, what I mean, how do you work with clients that maybe want to manage their triggers? I mean, maybe we just talk about anxious attachment. I mean, if you had a it depends on the client, of course, but I mean, are there things you might suggest?
Well, I guess I always kind of think, and you know, this in a way, part of this is kind of what I experienced as being quite helpful, you know, and I remember that. And then just through getting into attachment theory more, it's sort of been relevant. I mentioned that the adult attachment interview, just really getting a history. Because again, I think a kind of history, like a mapping out, is quite a, it's not looking at anything right or wrong. It's almost like shining a torch and going, oh, what happened? Anything there relevant? Kind of, I mean, that's, you know, without being flippant about it. But I think gathering a history, learning about how that person is in relationship, what they learned in relationship themselves, who they might have gone for support, how things like emotions were modeled, how discipline was handled in the household, getting those kind of, I guess, it's their own data in a way, and just seeing, you know, does any of that influence you now? So that would probably be, that's often a way I work with attachment and attachment issues, I would say. But I think even if somebody would just, you know, I'm thinking of somebody like those programs kind of, where I can't think of the name of it, but where they sort of trace their family lineage. It's, I can't think of the name of it, but that
I
kind of,
can't
oh,
either.
that happened. I didn't realize that. And of course, whether whether one subscribes to it, but I think the sort of inherited family systems can come into play, of course. So I think
Definitely.
really just looking at it almost as a as an observer sometimes. I think often people are quite dysregulated or activated, understandably, when they come into counseling. And I think often finding ways to start to regulate that nervous system whilst almost going on a journey of discovery, I think can be really helpful. So there not being any wrong or right, and it will probably look different for each and every person, but that's something I'm always drawn to, an attachment history, learning about what people learned, and then also just recognizing what happens now, what their relational history now, are they in a relationship? If so, what are the dynamics? If they're not, what's happening?
And just to pull one part of that, yeah, I mean, the context, I guess, getting people to look at their histories and, potentially their generational histories, doing a genogram or something. I mean, it can be really, really helpful, I think, for clients that perhaps have a, symptom that they can't really explain. And then, looking back, it really, really kind of makes sense to them. And I think that is tremendously helpful. I mean, that's, kind of psychodynamic, really, isn't it? But also then looking at ways that they can regulate their nervous systems in the present when they are triggered. What it depends on the client again, but what kind of techniques maybe could people use if they are triggered in the present in a relationship?
So I guess this sort of comes into this, but also something I realize I wanted to say in response to the last bit, which is psychoeducation, I think, can be really helpful. And again,
Definitely.
recognizing that they are inherent in all of us and we're all such different humans, but actually, it can be really validating to almost go a bit like, this isn't anything you chose. You didn't choose to be you. You didn't choose to be born into the system you were, much like, the bush outside didn't choose to be a bush. The dog didn't choose to be a dog. But these attachment systems are inherent in all of us. And they're really great things, but they can be quite difficult things to formulate depending on what we've experienced. So I guess that could be quite helpful, I've found. And again, bringing it back to myself, I remember finding that really helpful, a kind of sense of, oh, okay, I'm not making it all up.
Absolutely.
But there are, even if the story has been completely different, other human beings kind of are going to experience it. Depending on what happens, that's subjective to them. But this notion of looking to our caregivers to almost go, okay, what do we do here? What am I doing? What I need this, can you give it to me? So the psychoeducation, I think, can be really helpful. And also things like trying to activate, I guess, like the parasympathetic nervous system. I mentioned about fight or flight, which is often synonymous with our in-breath. So trying to lengthening the out-breath, and often like a longer breath. There are various practices out there, soothing rhythm breathing, yoga nidra, non-sleep deep rest, lots of different practices that are kind of geared to, whichever one works best. I think that's the thing, we're trying it out, because for some people, if they've experienced a lot of trauma, that stuff could be potentially quite activating. So it's just being really just checking in. It could be sound waves. There's a lot more research now on things like sound waves, nature, just, but I've always quite liked the conscious deep breathing. It's not necessarily a formal mindfulness practice, still probably mindful doing it, but it's like trying to activate that parasympathetic system to almost get into a more soothing based place, which can then hopefully allow some of this type of investigation, around type of attachment systems, family history, and then moving towards a place of hopefully being, feeling, having the client or whoever, having the autonomy to experiment with different ways of operating in relationships.
Absolutely. I mean, the breathing, I guess, as you say, just trying to find, a coping strategy, a strategy to kind of de-escalate the nervous system. And that's not going to be the same thing for everybody. So I guess trying stuff out. I mean, in terms of, I mean, listening to your podcast, I listened to your podcast with Paul Gilbert the other day, which I loved. I mean, just bringing in some of that. I mean, is there a place for mindfulness, self-compassion practice in terms of managing attachment. Yeah, I mean, but could you?
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, this Paul Gilbert was probably, when I wanted to learn more, I learned a lot kind of from his work, and I think he's a really great, what I was kind of just saying, that notion of, he really embodies that biopsychosocial approach, which I think is a really humbling one and a kind of validating one, which is okay, depending on what's happening out there, in here, back then, all that stuff is going to be important.
Yeah,
We're not alone in
absolutely.
that. But I think compassion is really important because so much of attachment-based issues, attachment trauma, relational trauma is linked with not having that secure, safe base, which is synonymous with compassion.
Yeah,
Compassion,
definitely.
as Paul so rightly says, it isn't just kind of a love and woolliness. That's part of it for sure. It's great, but actually, it can involve boundaries. It can involve saying no. The kind of stuff that kids do need to hear, but there are ways that can be helpful and ways it can be harmful. So I think if someone has had has experienced any kind of relational conflict, relational trauma, wounding growing up, I think compassion is really, really important. Actually just validating one's own experience. This isn't my fault. I didn't choose to have this family system. But I'm finding myself here. What do I need? And I think it's a really great way of, again, getting that parasympathetic system online, but also starting to relate in a different way. Because a lot of people who are struggling, they may not be in relationships. They may be quite isolated. So the only voice they may be hearing could be that inner critical, almost parent type voice. But even if they are in a relationship, it may be that for that moment, they can't get that compassionate need met by that partner. And that's not a, it doesn't mean it's wrong. It's just that's how it is right now for
Yeah,
them. And
sure.
trying to start to, I guess, give it to themselves, learn stuff. So I think, yeah, it's a really great thing that you raised there. Mindful self-compassion, mindful compassion is so important for sure.
I mean, I couldn't agree more. I mean, almost like, I don't know, creating a secure attachment within yourself, really. I mean, I talk a lot about mindfulness and self-compassion on the show. It's often a very, very difficult thing, I think, for people to connect with. We all have this inner critic, don't we? With some people, it's louder than, in other people, but it's generally always there. And often I think it is a bit of a journey for people to really, really connect with self-compassion. Often it can seem a bit woolly, but I think it is incredibly important as a therapeutic intervention. If people can kind of incorporate self-compassion practice in their own lives, I think it can be a real game changer. And
Totally.
meditation as well. I read from your book, you have your own meditation practice.
Yeah, so that's been something that's been really, talking about compassion and, certainly, coming back to me, trying to meet myself with that compassion, which is certainly like it's a journey, for
It is.
sure. But I've almost found, and this is, I want to say this in my head, this sounds like a compassionate thing to say. It's kind of a non-negotiable. It's like a compassionate boundary of myself. There are things that I can kind of go, okay, yeah, that's all right. I've let that slip a bit, or I can allow myself. But I'm really, it's just been so huge and continues to be just really powerful. I don't almost know why. I kind of think I do, and then some days where I think I don't know why, but that was just there was something quite powerful. And I think that again, as I kind of always recognize meeting things quite cognitively head on, and in therapy there's that could be that speak of going in top down or bottom up, the sort of limbic system, and it's quite a long, I think it's a limbic system. Again, talking about Paul Gilbert, he's pretty good with this stuff. I recognize not it's not my area of expertise per se, but it was something I always resisted. It was like, okay, what's the answer? What's the clever way? And so we're talking a lot about science, but with meditation, it's like it's kind of paradoxical in some ways because it is an act of doing, but then there's nothing to do, kind of thing. And that for me was a really, I was like, well, I don't think I've ever experienced that before. It just started to make sense. I've tried a lot of different stuff. I think for me, I like to keep a non-dogmatic practice. So again, I say it's a non-negotiable, but it's it's whatever feels right in the day. I think sometimes it might be, you know, if I'm struggling or had a hard day, I recognize going into a place of what's the deepest form of meditation. I have to kind of pause and just say, what do I need right now? Much like maybe like, what did my child need? Like coming back to attachment, what would be most helpful? Would like really deep breathing be helpful now? Would some kind of yoga nidra type lying on the floor just relaxed? Or would actually, if I'm really, really overthinking stuff, actually, would it just be helpful to kind of just sit and adopt a kind of, well, this is what is here right now. I wonder, is there anything useful here? Is there anything not? Just because I think it's that meditation allows me, which, and again, work in progress for sure. And I think it's probably be my life's work. And I think I'm okay with that today, but to respond and not react, really. So yeah, a really big part of my life. And I find it can be a really big part of counseling and psychotherapy as well. You know, this notion of it's a really powerful tool, but it's also that thing that it is, if that makes sense. It is what is. And I think that can be quite helpful when people are really dysregulated and wanting an answer, to actually just bringing it back to that simplicity of the here and now, the breath, or anything that kind of works. But yeah, really important for sure.
Yeah, and in my life as well. I mean, meditation, this is a big statement. I mean, meditation has literally changed my life, really. I mean, it is.
Yeah.
But it's not always a quick fix. And it is so true, isn't it? It's not goal-directed.
Yeah.
But I guess there is some goal direction there, because you're sitting down to meditate. And, you know, and cognitively, you know, I mean, I read the papers and everything. Yeah, it's like, you know, maybe it does this to the brain and that to the brain. But it's also something else about it, isn't there, that I can't actually put into words. It's very,
absolutely,
very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, really powerful. It's a bit like, you know, and I think that's the thing I recognized sort of when I was first starting. It was, oh, I've got to get this right. I've got to get to the, you know, almost moving through the schools. Okay, here's the 10-minute guided practice. Cool. Yeah. Now I'm going to experiment with this. Oh, there's, and actually it's like all of it is amazing, but it has to be subjective, I think. You know, for me, and again, I think it does link with attachment and sense of self and just that kind of sense of regulating, because I think, you know, I guess one area we haven't touched on that I think comes into this, which is, you know, things like codependency, which I very much see aligned with attachment. You know, there's so many different meanings to that word. But if someone has perhaps negated their sense of self for years, their story could almost be, well, I did the meditation I was told to do. And actually, it's taking that wisdom, but also going, okay, what most resonates? So I'd hope that for each and every person, and certainly that's, it's taken a while, and say some days it can still be difficult, because I don't know about you, but certain weeks it seems there's kind of new styles and new types of therapy and new ways of working every week, which is exciting, but I find it a bit jangling sometimes as someone who's
so true.
Yeah, so I think just kind of whatever works, you know, much like I kind of think of, if I'm walking in the woods and it's just one of those, well, this is the woods and I really like it, you know, that's that sort of akin to that.
Yeah.
But this is present. So yeah, I would definitely encourage it, and encourage people to experiment, allow themselves the autonomy to recognize what's resistance perhaps, but also recognize, you know, if there's something you don't like or it feels uncomfortable, there's other stuff to try and find what you need for sure.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Yeah, I guess walking in the woods, you know, I mean, our listeners probably won't want me to talk about forest therapy again. I've really talked about it probably far too much.
Oh,
on
nice.
The show. But I really, really love the idea of forest therapy.
Yeah.
I'm conscious of the time, and I have to ask you about your podcast.
Can
say a bit about your podcast, and also how people can get hold of you if they want to get hold of you for therapy, or they want to listen to the podcast? And obviously we'll put all of your links on our social media, but could you say a bit about the podcast?
Thank you for asking. You know, it's a pleasure to speak about it, and it continues to be a real source of joy. So the podcast that I do it's called The Journey Home, and it's running conjunction with a company called Portobello Behavioral Health. So initially, just as a kind of brief backstory, it was just something I'd kind of thought about. I guess it's a bit similar to, well, there's something to this counseling thing. I'm not quite sure yet, but I recognize I could talk myself out of this, but I'll just see what happens. And it just through kind of people that I'd found inspiring and learned from and spoken with, I just found myself thinking this could be really fun. So just gathered a few people, just asked a few of my old kind of critic thinking no one would get back, and people did. And the idea kind of being to promote a space where people can share a lived experience of mental health, addiction, and any kind of multitude of topics that would resonate with the guests and hopefully people listening. And my aim is to promote awareness of these areas and hopefully serve as a pathway to therapeutic services, however that might look, or any kind of recovery or meditation, just anything that resonates with that person. We're in our second season now. I'm not sure when this one goes live, but episode three will be dropping tomorrow. We're now doing fortnightly. Work has got a bit busier, so just kind of trying to fit it all in. And
Yeah, that's always a challenge.
yeah, I guess almost not be hypocritical, some of this stuff that we
Yeah.
talk about, and then working long hours trying to get this
Yeah.
stuff done. But it is really enjoyable. I'm learning a lot. I'm hopefully, my aim is to give a lot of different areas. You mentioned forest therapy,
Yeah.
just anything that someone might resonate with, that kind of idea of it not being a dogmatic space at all, it being a
Yeah.
space where this is kind of what the individual has found helpful. That's how they work, it's what they're passionate about. Over to you. Does any of that resonate? You the listener. So yeah, you can find it on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, really wherever you get your podcasts. Those are the two main ones. There is an Instagram, which is at TJH. Let me just double check that's right. Sorry, Mark. I'm going to
That's
just
okay,
double
no
check
worries.
before I. So the journey home on Instagram, which is, gosh, this is slightly embarrassing. My Instagramming is not great, but I'll have a look.
You know, I'm going to give you a second to look it up. I'm going to say to our listeners, I've just started. I listened to a couple because we were doing the interview, but I've subscribed because I really like it. I mean, the breadth of subjects. I
Oh,
mean, this
thank
morning
you.
I was listening to, I forget her name. It was a Buddhist psychologist.
Oh, Mindy Newman, yeah.
Yeah, I loved that episode. Yeah, I mean, so I really would recommend it to our listeners. I mean, I'm really
Oh, thank you,
enjoying it.
Mark.
Yeah.
So it's called, so the Instagram is TJ at TJH podcast. And that's just a kind of space where episodes will get posted up. Any information on that will get posted up. If anybody wanted to get in touch with me, you can send an email to inquiries at PB. Let me just double check. This is really poor organization here, Mark. I do apologize.
Oh, it's okay. I mean, we therapists are not always known for our organizational abilities, are
yeah.
they?
Zero, dear. This is not too good. There is a an email. So, yeah, if you check out on the Instagram, that's probably the best place
Sure.
to look. And then, yeah, I'm gonna have a look just now, just to clarify, because if I gave the wrong address, that would probably be
Yeah, it's okay.
not super helpful.
And opposite.
Inquiry at portobellobh.com. So yeah, reach me on there. And
Brilliant.
yeah.
Yeah, and at the end, I mean, after we finish recording, Matthew, send me an email with all of your links, and I'll get my colleague Joe is the kind of tech wizard behind the
Okay,
podcast,
will do,
so I'll
yeah.
get him. So yeah, put all of your links along on our social media
Amazing,
sites and
thank
also
you.
with the podcast. Time's gone so quick today, but I'm going to ask you the final question that I always ask our guests. I mean, what are your go-to coping strategies for sustaining good mental health? I mean, what do you do in your life?
So I guess it comes back to meditation for me. And certainly in difficult times, I think that's a real constant, but it's adapting to kind of what's going on. So I think compassion that we touched on is really important.
Yeah.
Reaching out to safe people, I think, is a really important one. We didn't, I don't know if we explicitly said that, but I think, I've always liked that kind of notion of we're wounded in relationship and we heal in relationship. Actually
Yeah, so true.
connecting with safe people, reaching out, but just doing, whatever self-care looks like. So for me, I guess that's, it's meditation, it's water, it's countryside, it's dogs, it's family. But yeah, just kind of, I think trying to activate that parasympathetic nervous system, bringing the soothing system more online, and just kind of coming back to whatever that difficult thing was with a response, but with a appropriate response. But yeah, compassionate, loving awareness, I would say, really.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. I mean, before we finish, is there anything that you would like to have said that I haven't given you the opportunity, Matthew?
I think that's, really, it has whizzed by, and I think you've held the space fantastically, because I think it's such a, a broad topic, and
It's
it continues. I think
enormous, yeah.
as we humans evolve, it continues to evolve. I
Yeah.
think certainly one thing that I think can be really helpful is, exploring communication. I guess that's another thing, effective communication, because yeah, we're often it's two wounded people probably asking the same thing, but
Yeah.
due to the type of reactivity that's often associated with different attachment styles, it may not come out that way, and it can be pretty tough. So often just, mindfully stepping back, anchoring, doing whatever you need to do, and then, looking at what might be more effective ways of communication can be really helpful. So I guess that would be something I'd say also. But yeah, it's been a real pleasure, and such an honor to be asked. Thank you, Mark. It's been a privilege.
Oh, and it really has been a privilege to talk to you, and thank you. I mean, attachment is an enormous subject, so thank you so much for, as I think anyone that's listened to today's show and doesn't really understand attachment, I think will have a much, much better understanding from your explanation. So thank you again for coming on the show, Matthew, and it's been really, really
Thanks,
nice to
Mark.
meet you.
Pleasure. You too.
Well, I'd just like to thank Matthew again for coming on the show. Again, a really, really fascinating show. I think Matthew covered attachment in a really, really excellent way. I mean, as I said when I kind of was asking the questions about attachment, it is an enormous subject with lots of different nuances and, dependent on the relationship you're in, your attachment pattern may change. Attachment patterns are flexible. But I think, as Matthew said on the show, it's important to remember that whatever attachment style we have, we've developed in order to stay alive. I mean, that is literally why we develop the attachment styles that we have. If we were living, in a kind of hunter-gatherer society, we would need these attachment styles in order to survive. So I think it is important to remember that. And I think it is also important to remember when you or your partner are having, enormous feelings, provoked by attachment style, to be self-compassionate and forgiving of each other, because, attachment styles do bring enormous feelings, and we whilst it may look very different for somebody who is maybe avoidantly attached to somebody who is perhaps anxiously attached, the physiological arousal and the stress going on, is exactly the same. In fact, there was a attachment researcher called Mary Ainsworth, and she conducted The Strange Situation. And in a nutshell, The Strange Situation was there would be a room with some toys, and there would be a stranger sitting in the room. And then the mother would bring in her child and sit in the room with the stranger and the toys for a while. Inevitably, the child would start playing with the toys, and then the mother would leave. And then the mother would return. And interestingly, with the three main attachment types, with the anxious child, when mother returned, the child would leave. Well, the moment mother left, child wouldn't be interested in the toys. But when mother came, child would grab onto mum, not want to let go, not be interested in the toys, be very, very kind of emotionally dysregulated. With the avoidant child, the mother would come in and the avoidant child would barely even look up and continue playing with the toys. However, the kind of physiological stress levels of, both of these children were monitored. And even though the avoidant child looked as though they didn't care, the level of emotional dysregulation and stress was exactly the same as the anxiously attached child, which is interesting. And the child that was secure would notice mother had left, And then when mother came back, the child would reconnect with mum. And then once they felt secure, then they would go back and start playing with the toys. But again, you know, there is no wrong or right in terms of attachment. And what Matthew was saying about shame, I think is true. I mean, often I think people can read, you know, excellent books like Attached, and then they can feel shamed around their own attachment pattern. But we all, every member of the entire world population has different. We all have our own attachment patterns, you know, whether they be anxious, you know, avoidant, disorganized, secure, you know, or a mixture of both, you know, and they do change in relationships. So I think it is important to be compassionate to ourselves and compassionate to others. I think it was a really, really great show. And it is a topic I think that we'll cover again. And also Matthew talking about, I think meditation, which, you know, as our listeners know, I've talked a lot about on the show. And self-compassion practice. I think often, as I said in the show, self-compassion practice can seem very woolly to people, but it is. And it's also research-based, this, you know. I mean, it really is incredibly important, you know, and changes a lot of things, you know, and creating a secure attachment to ourselves is possible, but only really through self-compassion. And as Matthew said, I think self-compassion practice can provide a voice that balances out the perhaps negative inner critic. So another great show for season five. Got a few really interesting ones coming up. Got a late counsellor going to come on shortly and talk about arguments, which should be a very, very interesting show. But for now, I'd like to thank all our listeners for listening. As always, we wouldn't have a show without you. To thank Matthew so much for coming on the show and for, you know, what was a fascinating interview. And look after yourselves, look after each other, and look after the planet. I'll see you soon on the next episode. Thanks again for listening to the show. If you have been affected by any of the topics on this show or any other of our shows, if you're in the UK, then please reach out. Samaritans can be contacted on 116 123. Now, the GP is also a good source of contact and can be the gateway for, you know, counselling services and other mental health support. Reach out to your mental health support team, mental health first aider, or trusted friend, colleague, or family member. We have a lot of international listeners. So if you're listening from a non-UK country, then please reach out to, you know, your country's healthcare and mental health care providers. And remember, it's okay not to be okay.
Hashtag psychotherapy unfogged with Mark Fielding.